My name is Lisa Bickmore, and I'll be chairing this session. You are to be in the session only if you have a ticket or a pre-printed name tag. I would like to begin by introducing our speaker and our respondent. Eric Olson was born in Oakland, California in 1954. He was raised in Tempe. He received a B.A. in English from Brigham Young University in 1977 and received his Juris Doctorate degree from the University of Virginia in 1980. Practiced law in Louisville, Kentucky for 3 years. For the last 8 years, he has practiced with the law firm of Van Cott, Bagley, Cornwall, and McCarthy in Salt Lake City, Utah, specializing in commercial litigation. He taught institute part-time at the University of Louisville, and he's married to the former Marilyn Clark, and they are together the parents of 6 children. Responding to Brother Olson's paper will be Thomas Durham, professor of music at BYU, where he serves as an assistant chair of the music department. He's authored 4 music theory manuals, articles about music, and has published 11 choral works. He's the composer of hymn number 171, With Humble Heart, in the LDS hymnal. Also has sung with the Mormon Tabernacle Choir for 11 years. During his mission in New England 20 years ago, he served as the personal secretary and special assistant to Paul Dunn. We'll begin now with Eric's paper, and then after that, Thomas Durham will respond. And we should have time for some questions, so pay attention.
To make things go a little faster, I'm not going to cite all the sources in the paper. There aren't any very exotic ones anyway, so don't feel too bad, but it'll go a lot more smoothly if I don't. Starting out with a quote. I haven't purposely tried to embellish or rewrite history. I've tried to illustrate points that would create interest by simply putting history in little finer packages. And the title of the paper is Little Finer Packages. That's from Paul Dunn, quoted in the Arizona Republic, February 1991. Institutions adopt labels to communicate their priorities and standards. Based on these labels, both insiders and outsiders form their expectations of the institution. When I go into the country's best yogurt shop, TCBY, down the street, I expect to enjoy an exceptional dessert. Across the street at Blockbuster Video, I expect to find available the latest popular movie releases. At Discount Tires, I look for tires at a bargain price. Best Foods, Superior Muffler, CoverGirl Makeup, each label tells us simply and immediately what to expect and for what the institution stands. With divine approval, we refer to ourselves as the true church. We do not speak of the nice church, of the special church, of the philosophically valid church, of a pretty great church, or even of a pretty true church. We speak of the true church. For members of the church, this label is, at a minimum, a statement of authority. God has given the church permission to act in his name. Thus, the church is true. But to the outsider, the uninitiated, the inexperienced, and the unpersuaded, the phrase the true church is a promise of truth, as in candor, accuracy, and clarity. In a word, honesty. Whatever the label true says to us about authority, it speaks to others of the highest standard of credibility. Such an expectation is consistent with our canonized declaration. We believe in being honest, true. When we, as Latter-day Saints, are less than credible, less than candid, less than accurate, we belie our divinely sanctioned label as the true church in the eyes of others, and we present ourselves as something less than honest and therefore less than true. This next section is titled The Sad Tale of Elder Paul H. Dunn. This paper had its genesis in the recent publicity regarding Elder Paul H. Dunn and his stories of personal war exploits and sports accomplishments. Elder Dunn served as a soldier in the Pacific during World War II. Both before and after, he played baseball briefly for farm league teams. Later, he commenced teaching in the church education system, referred to hereafter as CES, and obtained a doctorate in education. In 1964, he was called as a member of the LDS Church's First Council 70. Many of us, no doubt, fondly remember Elder Dunn as a folksy, engaging speaker who kept us awake in our youth during long, tedious conferences. As I listened to Elder Dunn in my youth, I formed 2 distinct impressions, that he was a war hero with extensive combat service and that he had played Major League Baseball. Elder Dunn did not speak truthfully regarding his war and sports experiences. He states, "I have on some occasions changed the names of people involved to provide confidentiality, combined events to try to make a more pointed or vivid illustration, and added emphasis or detail to stories to increase their teaching impact." The most striking instance of this change, combination, and addition is the Harold Brown-Ralph Cockcroft story. The story is that Harold Brown was mortally wounded with 67 shrapnel wounds during the assault on Okinawa in World War II. Brown survived the night in excruciating pain and died the following day in Elder Dunn's presence with a stirring, deeply patriotic message on his lips. This is a fine story, vivid and moving, except Harold Brown is still alive. The dead man was one Ralph or Philip Cockcroft, perhaps a less admirable fellow. No one died after surviving the night with 67 shrapnel wounds, and there were no patriotic last words. The account of the Brown-Cockcroft experience was neither misstatement nor exaggeration. A misstatement is an erroneous statement of fact made because one is ignorant of the true facts or has been misinformed. My 5-year-old might insist that 4 nickels is a larger allowance than a quarter, or relying on incomplete data, researchers might report a poisonous chemical to be harmless. An exaggeration is an overstatement or enhancement of an actual event. The 2-foot trout that got away and the hot car that can go from 0 to 60 in 3 seconds are exaggerations. The Brown-Cockcroft story was neither a misstatement nor an exaggeration. It was a falsehood, a misrepresentation. The central event of the story, the heroic passing of a noble soul with a powerful final statement of patriotism, never happened in any form. The change combined ad approach produced a story of events that never took place. The response is this, and this is quoting Elder Dunn, "The places and events from my own life I have described were actual experiences. I did not state that I fabricated those stories because I had been in the places and experienced the events. Yet it is not enough that Cockcroft died in armed conflict on a faraway Okinawa beach within a few yards of the storyteller, or that the storyteller knew Brown, or even that Brown or Cockcroft entertained patriotic feelings. None of these facts, standing alone, was the point of the story. The point of the story was the heroic passing and the patriotic message. If those particular events did not happen, then they did not happen, notwithstanding real people or a real setting. No amount of change, combination, addition can make accurate and true what is not and never was so." This also goes for Elder Dunn's Major League Baseball experience. There is a difference between the Pocatello Cardinals or Ontario Orioles and the St. Louis Cardinals. It is the difference between a justice of the peace and a Supreme Court justice, between a paramedic and a heart surgeon, between a short order cook and a French chef. Again, this is not a mistake of fact or a fish story. It is a distortion of what actually happened. My point in detailing this is not to be critical of Elder Dunn or to dwell on his poor judgment, but to underscore the precise nature of his stories. If we elect to rationalize, downplay, or disregard the false components of these tales, we embark into uncharted spiritual, moral, and intellectual territory where the word truth loses all meaning. Thus, it is perplexing to read, and this is the First Presidency statement, "We have had no way of fully or finally verifying the accuracy or inaccuracy of the current allegations or accounts that are now under challenge." In response, one might suggest a trip to Odessa, Missouri to visit a living, breathing Harold Brown, or a check of the St. Louis Cardinals rosters for 1940 through 1950 for Elder Dunn's name. Final verification of accuracy is not a hard issue. These actual experiences simply did not occur. I have heard legal scholars speak of a principled analysis, and by this I understand that they mean the consistent application of defined standards or rules to an assortment of fact scenarios without variation for personalities, subjective preferences, or idiosyncrasies. For instance, such a principled analysis is central to the constitutional guarantees of equal protection and due process of law. In theory, the law applies in the same fashion whatever one's race, sex, ethnic origin, wealth, or office may be. The true church must also have a principled analysis of truth and accuracy, one that applies equally to those favorably disposed as well as to those ill-disposed towards the Latter-day work. Suppose an author of the last century proposed to portray the truth of life among the Latter-day Saints in Utah. Suppose further that, in pursuit of the higher ideal of exposing the true corruption of Mormonism, this author embellished her own limited experiences in the church with first-person eyewitness stories of nefarious deeds among the elders and of patriarchal oppression, deeds and oppression to which she was not actually a witness. She too might defend such methods as merely an expansion of actual experiences, a change, combination, addition to serve a higher purpose and a greater good. And I would reference you to Hugh Nibley's book, Sounding Brass, critiquing the work of Fanny Stenhouse and Eliza Webb and Irving Wallace to see a treatment of a faithful Latter-day Saint of this particular approach. If the methods of such an author are to be condemned by standards of accuracy, and if her sincere belief that she is serving the greater good with her fabrications afford no mitigation, then what shall we do with the change, combination, addition approach applied by one in the name of church education? A principled analysis dictates the rejection of anything that is less than true, no matter how sincerely presented, no matter how convincingly told, no matter the level of our affection for the teller, no matter how much we regard the church authorities. The same ruler must measure both versions of reality. If anything, an institution adopting the label, the true church, must submit to even more precise measurement. If we change the ruler to suit our instincts or preferences, then the ruler ceases to be a ruler or standard. We drift into a vacuum of relativity where anything and everything is true as long as it bears the right stamp, is spoken by the right person, or serves the right purpose. We start wrapping the truth in little finer packages until it is no longer truth, but just a big cute package with the mere shadow of truth lost somewhere inside. And it's ironic, I guess, that the bottom line denunciation of liberal religion and situation ethicists by church authorities has often been the notion that context dictates. The next section is headed Church Education. Is the truth good enough? The origins of the Brian Cockcroft story are as follows, according to Elder Dunn. I came home many months later, talking to kids in a teaching situation. All I did was take Harold Brown's relationship with me and combine it with Ralph Cockcroft's dying. Similarly, the St. Louis Cardinals story came about because, and this is quoting again, youngsters can relate better to a major league team than to farm teams, end quote. The made-up stories had as their justification to, quotations, create interest, to illustrate a point, and to increase their teaching impact, end quotation. Significantly, each emerged in a teaching setting, and specifically in the teaching of youth. Ben's professional background, it is a fair conclusion that his stories grew out of his employment in the CES. Now, obviously, the CES isn't the only context in the church where this might happen, but it is the only context in which the teachers are paid and serve full time. The question is, then, why did Elder Dunn feel the need to change, combine, and add? To answer this, I consider my own experience and that of others with the CES. I have a friend who obtained his doctorate in religion at a respected Eastern university where he developed expertise in a specific religious subject matter of great interest to the church, but in which few church members are trained. My friend is an extremely faithful fellow with a deep and tempered testimony of the gospel and the standard works. He is also a sincere and enthusiastic teacher. He returned to Utah to finish work on his PhD dissertation. Several academic positions were open in religious studies departments in universities across the country. Before applying for those positions, however, he sought out the possibility of teaching on the religion faculty of Brigham Young University. He first taught two courses at BYU. The courses were well received by most students, although some complained that the approach was too serious and too challenging. Eventually, my friend was informed that, for fear that he might not be a team player, BYU was not likely to offer him a faculty position. It was suggested that those in charge of the CES might be reassured if he attempted to come up through the seminary and institute ranks as they had. Mustering commendable humility and still driven by his desire to put his hard-won training at the service of the church, my friend pursued the seminary option. He was assigned to teach students at a predominantly LDS high school. After a week, the critiques came back. My friend was not, quotation marks, reaching all of the students, end quotation. His interests and method of instruction were beyond some of them. He was not sufficiently entertaining or overtly motivational. Despite his command of the subject matter, his native ability to teach, and his deep desire to be a teacher, he was judged not to be suitable for the CES. In response to the reviews, my friend concluded, I cannot run a three-ring circus and call that teaching. For my own part, I spent 7 years in the CES as a student and a couple of years as a part-time institute teacher back east. Three of my 4 seminary years were spent in Brother Jay's class. He was a master showman. We never fell asleep. Everything was positive and uplifting. As I reflect now, however, nothing I did under Brother Jay's influence had any direct impact on my testimony. At best, he made me comfortable while keeping me off the streets. And as a footnote here, I must admit that my adolescent powers of spiritual discernment were not superlative. Further, the nearly 20 years that have passed since my seminary days do somewhat undermine the currency of my personal experience in this regard. Yet, I did remember Brother Jay's stories, particularly those comforting accounts of miraculous occurrences and of our church history. With no real reason or inclination to doubt, I accepted all that he said as being so. On my mission, I had my eye out for miracles of the seminary story variety, but I saw very few, if any. I found that my own life in the mission rarely, if ever, intersected with the outwardly miraculous. On my mission, I also read occasionally from books on church history. What I found that was that church history, as told by B.H. Roberts, read a bit differently from what Brother Jay had taught. Though my confidence in and commitment to the church did not turn on the validity of the factual content of what I had learned in seminary, I was disappointed that the reality of applying the gospel in a wicked world had not been more accurately and candidly presented. After my mission, I visited Brother Jay. By then, he had taught Institute for 3 years and was on the faculty of BYU. I mentioned to him the hard realities that I had learned on my mission and my disappointment that these things were obscured in my high school days. Brother Jay was genuinely pleased that I had come to a realization of such things. I learned that all along he was fully aware of and wrestled with the contradictions and difficulties that I had confronted. But he had felt that these were not appropriate for a CES setting. Simply put, from these experiences and many others, I come to the sad conclusion that the CES, in fact, if not in theory, may value entertainment and reassurance over honesty, insight, and accuracy. The gospel is often taught to the lowest common denominator. Faith is promoted at all costs. From the CES perspective, no matter how real or how true a principle or circumstance may be, it is of negligible instructional value if it does not excite the student or fit the correlated preconception. Such a system in the true church, a system in which truth and honesty are not the preeminent values, is perilous. It rewards the popular and the spectacular over the sincere and the competent. It drives basically good people to build little finer packages. One person put the inevitable dissonant question this way: isn't the truth good enough? The approach reminds me of when I was a kid in the 1960s. The television programs often showed a fellow bringing his date back to his apartment after a movie. He would turn down the lights, turn up the soft music, perhaps light her cigarette, and then slide in next to her on the couch with a drink in hand. This was referred to as setting the mood. And naive as I was, it was only in the 70s, as I became older and the media became bolder, that I fully understood what the fellow was setting the mood for. I now think of what was portrayed in the television program as someone creating a context for something to happen. In my experience, the CES worries much about creating a context for learning the gospel and forging a commitment to the church. The context can be the means of securing one's attention, of giving perspective, or creating emotion. For instance, I remember seminary testimony meetings held for effect at sunrise on a mountain near our high school in Arizona. I also remember quiet, reverent music used to create a context for a lesson or a talk. Indeed, some context is needed. It's hard to teach the truth in traffic. However, the pursuit of just the right context can become an end in itself, overwhelming the content of the essential message to be conveyed. It can degenerate into the circus that my friend feared and found he could not conduct. After 4 years of seminary, a year of BYU religion, and 2 months in the language training mission, I was thrust into missionary service in Tijuana, Mexico. As we tracked the dusty hills and squalid canyons with the offending, unfamiliar smells, the grinding poverty, and the chatter of incomprehensible voices, I was hard-pressed to find any context for spirituality. Gone was the hushed music and the quiet majesty of the rising sun. There could probably be no greater contrast to the atmosphere of the LTM than the tumult of a Tijuana sacrament meeting shared with a surly companion. I struggled for months to recognize feelings of the Spirit in the absence of what I had come to believe was a spiritual context. When I finally became aware that God and His Spirit were there all along, there was no need for enhancements. I was aware that I needed no temporal crutch for the things I felt and experienced to get through to my heart. This next section is called "What Are We Up To in Church Education?" A wise person knows the difference between context and content, between the pitch and the product. Long ago, President J. Reuben Clark, in the seminal speech on church education, observed, "You do not have to sneak up behind this spiritually experienced youth and whisper religion in his ears. You can come right out, face to face, and talk with him. You do not need to disguise religious truths with a cloak of worldly things. You can bring these truths to him openly, in their natural guise. Youth may prove to be not more fearful of them than you are. There is no need for gradual approaches, for bedtime stories, for coddling, for patronizing, or for any of the other childish devices used in an effort to reach those inexperienced and all but spiritually dead." That's a quotation from J. Reuben Clark, The Charted Course of the Church in Education, August 8, 1938. By the end of my mission, I had some sense of truth, to quote President Clark, natural guise. It did not need a string quartet, a clean, comfortable, quiet room, or a polished, resonant voice to reach my soul. 30 years after President Clark's address, Elder Spencer W. Kimball gave gathered CES employees the striking example of his discussion with a Harvard-educated returned missionary who had a few questions about the gospel. Elder Kimball's responses to that young man, as he related them, are instructive. One finds in these careful responses no smoke and mirrors, no trumpets, no circus, no bold believe or be damned declarations, no little finer packages. To the contrary, Elder Kimball consistently responded, and this is quoting him, "I don't propose to know all about these things, but have you thought about this? Wouldn't that pretty well answer the question? Now, this is the way it could be. Does that make sense?" End quote. The young man left the meeting comforted and enlightened. President Harold B. Lee counseled the CES professionals, "The first objective of CES was to teach truth And truth is knowledge of things as they are, and as they were, and as they are to come. Our objective is to teach so effectively that students will be free from error, free from sin, free from darkness, free from false tradition, from vain philosophies, and from untried, unproven theories of science. To teach the gospel that students will not be misled by purveyors of false doctrines, vain speculations, and faulty interpretations. President Lee then proceeded to cite numerous examples of sensational rumors peddled about the church in an effort to excite interest and promote faith. He made it clear that this was not a form of church education approved by him. From the words of these leaders, it is apparent that the sole concern of church education is to teach truth in its natural guise in order to convert souls to believe the gospel of Jesus Christ. And parenthetically, if the purpose were something less, I imagine the church would cancel the program and save the expense. Let us consider this chief concern. First, we are dealing with souls, eternal divine intelligences inherently endowed with agency. Second, we wish to convert, that is, to effect a change in the perspective, awareness, and propensities of that eternal entity. Finally, we are teaching spiritual information. Because the soul is both sacred and free, the acceptable means for seeking to effect the true change are limited. Some methods are to some degree coercive and deceptive in nature. They override the sacred agency of the student. Thus, while Satan may present sin with countless embellishments and deceits, we are constrained to convey truth in its natural guise. In fact, the only acceptable agent for teaching the truth is what we refer to variously as the Spirit, the Holy Ghost, or the Comforter. However denominated, we have in mind an outside influence, one that we cannot predictably nor decisively control. This influence is a gift, available as needed, but only at the election of and consistent with the purposes of God. This influence, in turn, can only act upon or entreat the free intelligences who are to be taught. It cannot force them. They will ultimately choose whether to yield to the Spirit or to follow conflicting desires. At best, the teacher is an agent, an instrument, bound by the most fundamental tenets of his or her religion to employ only those methods of teaching that neither override or misdirect the student's choice nor offend or supplant the essential Spirit that ultimately teaches. There are many seductive counterfeits for teaching in a manner consistent with these principles. These alternatives promise quicker results and greater success with less effort and enhanced opportunity for personal recognition. Now I'll name a few of these ways that can be approached other than the way that I think these church leaders would indicate. Number one, there's emotionalism and sentimentality. As my wife often says, anyone can kill a puppy. We can make others cry with a sad story or a tale of noble deeds well told. We can dim the lights, turn up the music, modulate the voice, and set the mood. Yet if tears are induced by the purely emotional, and then that is presented as a spiritual experience, we offer a counterfeit and may insulate the student from more legitimate and profound experiences with eternal things. Confusion over the emotional side of religious experience led young Joseph Smith to turn from the sectarian revivals to the sacred grove. There were no bells or whistles, no swelling music in that holy place. Yet there a 14-year-old boy, too young for even the seminary program, found God. Joseph later noted, "This first comforter, or Holy Ghost, the Spirit that teaches, has no other effect than pure intelligence in expanding the mind, enlightening the understanding, and storing the intellect with present knowledge. In this explanation of the teaching power of the Spirit, there is no hint of entertainment, self-indulgence, or emotion for the sake of emotion alone. A true spiritual influence expands and enlightens. It does not just amuse. We must take care that whatever context we create for teaching permits us to impart enlightenment and understanding. Jesus spoke of lamps without oil, barren fig trees, and salt lacking savor. Each item had the appearance of substance, but lacked the essential constituent that truly made of the thing what it outwardly appeared to be. The Spirit will naturally accompany truth, deeply felt, thoroughly examined, honestly depicted, and fairly presented. Then the recipient of such teaching can choose to believe, and with that choice have the confidence that he or she has been moved by truth in its purity, and not by some manipulation or contrivance. Second, superlatives and embellishment. The Scriptures record that when people get closest to God, words escape them. The reality of their experience, to quote Joseph Smith, defies all description. However, this has rarely stopped those standing at a significantly greater distance than that occupied by these chosen vessels and special witnesses from salting their discussion of divine things with the most effusive and speculative of language. Their rhetoric is a hodgepodge of glowing adjectives, dramatic verbs, and extravagant metaphors. No description is too outlandish and no declaration is too emphatic. Their tendency is understandable. The truths of the gospel are profoundly enlightening and fill us with satisfaction and confidence. They elicit a deep depth of gratitude and joy that bubbles over into our language. We employ enhancers such as the glorious gospel, special, marvelous, I know beyond a shadow of a doubt, from the bottom of my heart, and so forth. While the tendency is understandable, however, it is not necessarily advisable. Gospel instruction should inspire, as President Kimball emphasized, but that inspiration should arise principally from the essence of the message, not from the exaggerated or overwrought language of the messenger. The simplicity of Jesus' language in the Gospels is striking. His parables were plain and brief. He saw no need for embellishment. He accepted that his message might not be accessible to all. As Jesus said, "He that hath ears to hear, let him hear." Likewise, Nephi proclaimed, "I glory in plainness, I glory in truth." This is not a coincidental juxtaposition. The scriptures bear witness that the language of simplicity and plainness is the Lord's preferred vessel for conveying the truth. Constant words of comfort may ultimately be too comforting. The overuse of superlatives may anesthetize the listener. When everything is great and wonderful, then there is no differentiation or contrast, and in the end, nothing is great or wonderful. The student may come to perceive the rhetoric of confidence and comfort as a sign of insecurity, a fog of words intended to keep serious inquiry at a distance or to deny that something may be amiss. Such embellishments may also hinder practical application of simple gospel principles by obscuring the essence of the message. It is not enough simply to sound good. The third item is sensationalism. Closely related to superlatives is sensationalism. President Harold B. Lee showed particular concern about this tendency in the church. We love a juicy rumor, an outlandish prediction, or boundless speculation. President Lee, speaking of rumors that dealt with his patriarchal blessing, once noted, "There is one thing that shocks me. I have learned in some instances that those who have heard of these rumors are disappointed when I tell them they are not so. They seem to have enjoyed believing a rumor without substance of fact. I would earnestly urge that no such idle gossip be spread abroad without making certain as to whether or not it is true." Such observations have application to the CES. In my experience, there is no end of discussion about the Second Coming, the Three Nephites, visions, Ouija boards, Satan worship, and the Lost Tribes. We confuse keeping a student's attention with teaching. Miracle stories may excite, but they have several drawbacks. First, they do not represent the norm. The constant repetition of such tales creates unrealistic expectations. As I learned in Tijuana, and as the Book of Mormon abundantly teaches, the overtly miraculous is the exception, not the rule. Second, as President Lee warned, such stories may not be true or accurate. Events are subject to varied interpretation. These stories, by their very nature, tend to gain momentum and glitter with each telling. What factual bases once existed for the story become entirely obscured. Third, the miraculous and tales of such things are a discredited method of conversion or building faith. The scriptures and history warn that signs follow rather than precede faith. The miraculous merely confirms that on which we have already acted without seeing. And finally, these matters are sacred. Jesus cautioned his disciples not to disclose his most transcendent mortal experience, the Transfiguration, nor, in a broader context, to cast pearls before swine. The scriptures afford little license to peddle in public our most intimate encounters with the divine. In fact, we do not need and are rarely justified in pursuing such inspirational shortcuts. As we teach the gospel, we are seeking to transmit a perspective that arises from within as our spirit responds to the Holy Ghost. That spirit-driven perspective reveals the miraculous all around us. There is no need for big productions and esoteric inquiries that may dull us to subtle impulses and quieter voices. The Spirit guides us to see the hand of God in all that is about us. We come to realize that all things are a type and shadow of God, as the Book of Mormon prophets say. This mortal sphere, properly viewed, is God's witness. Students truly instructed will see God in all that is about them. Fourth item is finality. At times, there seems to be no greater sin in the church than for one to express uncertainty, doubt, or ignorance. When all else fails, we bear our testimony that we know this, that, and everything to be true. And that's a reference to a statement by Joseph F. Smith in Gospel Doctrine, just so you don't think that I'm out on a limb on this one. Brought, by the way, to my attention by a close friend of mine over at the church office building. Because I'd already said it, I was just glad that there was somebody to back me up on it. Students insist on answers, and we provide them. However, this approach is a bit at variance with the more careful and equivocal approach taken by President Kimball with the college student, as quoted above. While we crave certainty, our situation in this existence does not afford us that luxury. The scriptures caution that our human tendency is to look upon, quoting, the outward appearance while God sees the heart. Thus, as Paul acknowledged, in this existence we see eternal things as through a glass darkly. We should always remember that, in the realm of spiritual things, we are dealing with the mind and understanding of a being of inconceivable power and knowledge. The spiritual knowledge from him that we seek to convey to others must be filtered through our limited mortal comprehension, further diluted by our feeble human abilities to communicate. This is not to say that a significant level of personal certainty as to the basics is not available. Fundamental to any bona fide learning in the church is obtaining an awareness of God's reality and his continued involvement in mortal affairs, of Jesus' divine mission and sacrifice, and of our eternal relationship with both. This precious assurance defines an essential periphery. Within those limits are vital concerns on specific points that simply cannot be addressed with certainty and finality. When we speak definitively on such topics, we run the risk of ultimately sounding silly or being just plain wrong. Those who rely on us may not have the benefit of our sincere retraction when our ideas prove incorrect. And I would reference people to Brother McConkie's talk, "All Are Alike Unto God," where he made that specific retraction as to a point that he made quite emphatically in gospel doctrine or in Mormon doctrine. In making big, strong, final statements for short-run effect and assurance, we may sow the seeds of long-term doubt and disillusion. Finally, there is fabrication. The perils of this teaching method would seem manifest. One commentator has observed, concerned that they know the truth, whether in religion or in politics, enthusiasts may regard lies for the sake of this truth as justifiable. They may perpetuate so-called pious fraud.
Found in the very sources Mr. Olson cites. That concludes that particular response. Now, my own criticisms. As a university professor sworn to uphold the truth and to champion it above all else, what can I say? It's hard to argue against truth. But, I have to endorse the tone of everything Eric said. In discussions with family and friends, if you ask my family and friends, they will tell you I'm always on his side. But as a humanist, musician and artist, I have to at least attempt to disagree with some of Eric's comments. This will be tough because when playing the devil's advocate against somebody advocating the truth, the devil's advocate begins to sound like the devil. But I'll try, nevertheless. Eric contends that a greater good does not excuse altering the truth. Now, as an attorney, he knows a vital gap exists between statutory law and case law. Example, it's unlawful to cross the double yellow line in a car, but if crossed in order to avoid hitting a toddler, I think a greater good results. One must either obey the law and injure the child or disobey the law and avoid the injury. Well, maybe laws aren't truths. We can still find examples of deception or dishonesty not only tolerated in our society, but encouraged. I mean, Santa Claus is a lie that we perpetuate. And I don't know if a greater good comes about because of that or not, but we do that. A toupee is a lie. Unmarked police cars are a lie. And having recently been cited, I'm pretty sensitive about that right now. In the 40s, you remember, I don't remember, but from what I understand, FDR had press conferences where they only showed him from the waist up because the press was in collusion, was in an agreement, sort of, that they weren't going to show how he was crippled. And is that a deception? I'm not sure. But it was a deliberate deception on the public. A placebo is a deliberate lie, and a greater good comes about because of a placebo. And I don't know if in Eric Olson's world if he would outlaw placebos, but I think they do have a function. Now, Eric, as he had mentioned, takes an idealistic, absolutist view of truth. And I'll mention some of his quotes. The true church speaks to others of the highest standard of credibility, he said. He also said, when we are less than accurate, we belie our divine sanction as the true church. If we rationalize falsehoods, then truth loses all meaning. A principled analysis dictates the rejection of anything that is less than true, no matter how sincerely presented. The telling of untruths in support of higher truths can't be justified. We dare not manipulate facts for some greater good. And last, he said, the truth is good enough. More or less is of no positive eternal consequence. Now, these statements consonate nicely with Christian theology and ideology, don't they? But not Christian practice. After after exploiting Esau and annexing his birthright, Jacob conspired with his mother in a major deception involving Isaac. Jacob lied to Isaac at least three times in order to secure his blessing. Christians and Jews alike might argue that this deception and manipulation of the facts resulted in positive eternal consequences. There's a Hindu proverb that says, one should never lie unless for a greater good. Now, no such flexibility as policy exists in Christian theology, does it? All we can do is find examples of the flexibility and derive the principle, which seems to be in conflict with the theology. So we go round and round. For the sake of argument, let's concede to Eric this absolutist view of truth, this idealistic view of truth. Little wonder he didn't respond well to the Paul Dunn matter. Facts were added, changed, or combined. But as an absolutist on truth, Eric's got bigger problems than Paul Dunn now, much bigger. In support of his arguments, he didn't mention all, to streamline his paper, he wasn't able to mention all of his sources, but in his paper, I have his sources. He cited all of the following: Joseph Smith, the Scriptures, Joseph Smith's History of the Church, General Conference Reports, and several general authorities. Let's examine each. If, as Eric says, the true church must submit to even more precise measurement, how can his response to the following incongruities found in the true church be any different than his response to the Paul Dunn matter? Will anything be left of his faith as he jettisons each offender from his absolutist perch? First, Joseph Smith. His 1837 version of the first vision is vastly different than his 1832 version. He added and changed several not incidental facts. For instance, he talks about two personages in the latter, and he doesn't mention that in the former. The religious revival in the 1837 account is not mentioned in the 1832 account. The condemnation of all churches, later but not sooner, and Joseph Smith being an instrument in the restoration of the gospel also is mentioned in the latter but not the former. The scriptures have undergone changes and have been subjected to combinations also. The new scriptures combine the inspired version of the New Testament with the King James. When I was in seminary and on my mission, I was taught that because Joseph Smith never finished the inspired version of the scriptures, we were not to take them as scripture. But we do now, don't we? The phrase "white and delightsome" from the Book of Mormon, among others, I'm sure, now reads "pure and delightsome." This 1985 change is at least the third revision for that phrase. The Doctrine and Covenants used to contain the five lectures on faith by Joseph Smith, but these were decanonized in the 20s by Heber J. Grant and have been missing from copies of the Doctrine and Covenants ever since. Joseph Smith's History of the Church is an example of combining and adding elements. Although the church represents that Joseph wrote this history, only 812 of the 2,200 pages were completed during his lifetime. This means over 60% of the history purportedly written by the prophet was completed when he was dead. Some of the material was lifted from other sources and changed to first person so it would sound as though Joseph had been present. General conference reports have been changed in the past. In his book, History and Faith, Richard Paul gives us an illustration. Elder Ronald E. Pullman gave an address at the October 1984 General Conference. I remember, I was present and in the tabernacle choir seats, and I really stood up to hear this talk, as I recall. His address, however, does not appear in the November 84 Ensign magazine, which contains the official proceedings of the conference. What appears instead is a substantially edited version which omits about 10% and drastically changes about 10%. I'm not going to bother to read the side-by-side versions, but maybe many of you are familiar with those, but there was a substantial revision. Elder Pullman is just one example of a general authority involved in changes such as this. Brigham Young changed his mind about dancing about five times between 1846 and 1856. One moment he's endorsing it, and the next he's prohibiting it. What was true about dancing apparently was not true shortly thereafter, and back and forth and back again. For years, as Eric mentioned in his talk, Elder Bruce R. McConkie's Mormon doctrine stipulated that blacks would not hold the priesthood in this life. But after 1978, he admitted that he had been wrong and simply changed the content of what he had written. Hubie Brown, a spellbinding storyteller beloved of this audience, used to relate a famous account about a current bush and his experiences as a young Canadian officer. Again, according to Paul, the story first appeared in print in 1939 and evolved over the next 36 years into a mythologized version that veered significantly from the facts. Still, the story embodied great truths, and thousands were blessed after hearing it, and it remains one of my mother's favorites. Eric speaks about the natural guise of truth, and as a musician, I listened very carefully, and his voice paused, and he highlighted natural guise. That's an important concept to him. But who knows what the natural guise of truth is? To me, Bach's C-sharp minor prelude is truth in its natural guise. But is it plainness? Is natural guise plainness, simplicity, brevity? Eric cites Christ's parables as paragons of plainness, simplicity, and brevity. But were they plain? If Jesus had been interested in brevity, rather than telling the story of the prodigal son, why didn't he just abbreviate it to something like, a trusting, loyal father never gives up hope on an errant son because the son might eventually come around? Or in the case of the parable of the two sons, why didn't he just condense it to this? God recognizes deeds, not promises. Was truth displayed in its natural guise, in plainness, in the parables? Apparently not, because after telling a parable, his disciples often remain confused. For example, it takes Jesus 7 verses in the 4th chapter of Mark to tell about the sower who went forth to sow, but it takes him 10 verses to explain what he said and the meaning of that. Vagueness, in fact, may have been Christ's objective in using parables. He didn't use them until later in his ministry when opposition to his teachings intensified. His opponents were ever on the lookout to catch him in offending the word, but by using parables, he could conceal the radical truths of his message in an enigmatic style from those who had ears but would not hear. Finally, if Christ's teachings are all that straightforward, obvious, and conspicuous, why have thousands of books, including several by LDS authorities, expounded on what he really meant? Why can so many divergent opinions justify themselves by citing the plain words of Jesus? Eric remarked that the single greatest evil he witnessed as a missionary in Mexico was when a parent would have a child tell the missionaries his mom and dad weren't home. The fact that this indiscretion looms larger on Eric's evil scale than enraged husbands chasing and beating their wives, bribery, and the distribution of contraband and drugs, strained my sympathy beyond its limits. One might characterize his remark as exaggerated, sensational, and emotional. Rhetorical strategies vilified in the body of his paper. May have killed a puppy there. I would plead with Eric to reevaluate that statement because such hyperbole saps away the credibility of an otherwise strong presentation. Now, just a personal comment about Paul Dunn. I practically lived with him for a year while I was his secretary and his assistant. We learn from this whole affair that the world is not necessarily a better place for knowing the truth. Everyone lost in this affair. Paul Dunn lost, the church lost, BYU lost, and Lynn Packer lost. I don't know any winners in the whole matter. Now, Eric didn't make Paul Dunn's motives an issue in his paper, so I won't defend or attack or address those. But he did make parables an issue. Talmage defines a parable as a brief narrative or descriptive allegory founded on real scenes or events, such as occur in nature and human life, and usually with a moral or religious application. Irrespective of the degree to which Paul Dunn's descriptive allegories have reconstructed the past, nevertheless, truths emerge just as they do in a Hugh B. Brown story or probably a Matthew Kelly story or any other parabolic narration. So what are we left with after all of this? Is truth relative? Does truth change? What is a lie? Do circumstances ever justify lying? I don't know. I don't know these answers. But in answering questions about truth, I echo Eric's statement when he said, the search never ends. I take relief in the prophet Joseph Smith's words when he said, quote, that which is wrong under one circumstance may be and often is right under another. This is the principle on which the government of heaven is conducted, by revelation adapted to the circumstances in which the children of the kingdom are placed. Unlike Lynn Packer, Paul Dunn's calling was not to report the facts, so much as it was to adapt the facts to the circumstances in which the children of the kingdom are placed. Is he therefore a liar? No, he's more artful storyteller than liar. Storytelling is an art. And as Picasso declared, art is a lie that helps us know the truth. Thank you.
We have time for perhaps one or two questions.
Were the general authorities aware that these stories were not true while he was telling them?
have to repeat your question to the microphone. She has asked if general authorities were aware that these stories that Paul Dunn told were untrue while they were being told.
I don't know. I mean,
I would have never admitted it.
Well, I just say that I'm not a general authority, and none of them have come to me and told me that they yes, they do. So there's a lot of rumors, but since I took a position against that, I better not be repeating them here.
Yeah, yeah.
I just sort of want to make two comments, and one is that you take an absolute position on truth, and there's, of course, a relative position on truth, and it seems like a median position there, one that Scott Peck sort of suggests, is the question of who you're embellishing the stories, who that serves, and I think research shows that most people tell white lies, and research also shows that they mostly tell those white lies for self-aggrandizement or that it's self-motivated. And I think what I find appalling about Paul Dunn's situation is that I don't believe he told those stories to benefit students. I believe he told them for self-aggrandizement. And that's what I object to more even than the fact that he shaded the truth, which we all do at some point. And I also think that we should feel a little responsible for the fact that he's been telling these stories for 25 years and no one ever checked up on it. Because when we listen to general authorities, we put a period after what they say. We don't consider it as a dialogue. We consider it as a statement. And I think if I told stories and no one ever questioned me, I might start not to think I had to show my sources, not to think I had to be so careful. And if we continue to ask them about their sources and challenge them to consider it a dialogue, they would probably be more careful about what they say.
I'm right that there's no question there.
Right.
Okay. Yes.
Well, as you were talking, Ms. Jolson, I agree with the kind of absolute truth. I don't get there. I believe in it. But I wonder, in the way you presented it, it was almost like it either has to be truth and boring or Jolson. And I feel like I've watched my kids go through it, and there has to be, I think there has to be the truth, but there also has to be entertainment or they won't. They have to be engaging teachers. And I've seen too many teachers, not in seminary, but other places, that know the truth and have the experience, but they don't connect with me. And so it seems like we need to have maybe the first part of the content, but also the context be maybe second.
Yeah, and the only point I was trying to make, and in a way it's interesting to see people's reaction, because I tried to start from the starting point that we say we're the true church. And that says one thing to us inside, so to speak. And it says another thing to our kids growing up. What did they expect? What did I expect as a teenager? And I assumed that everything they told me in seminary was so. I mean, that's just my assumption. I don't know if other people felt that way. I had a guy the other day who read this paper tell me that he was told in seminary instruction that what's important isn't what you say, but how they feel when they leave, because they won't remember what you say. But I remember what they said, and for the life of me, I can't remember how I felt when I left. And so my point being that all I'm saying is that if we're going to advertise ourselves as something, we need to recognize the consequences of being something different. And heaven knows, relative truth is part of my job. And that's why I don't like to play the game at church that I have to play at the office. And so I think that it's a question of priorities. Is our first question when we are confronted with teaching something to church, how can I sell this? Or is what I'm selling what I'm supposed to be selling, and then how can I sell it?
But it should not be one or the other.
No, I'm not. And if you read that in the paper, you have to remember a lot of this paper is still on the floor somewhere at my house, because you saw it didn't stay within time even then, and time seemed part of what didn't get in, but other things that I had to balance that notion, I ultimately had to make it an attorney would do this, an advocacy piece. And Tom took the right approach by speaking to the other side. That other side was the part that remained on the floor, because, you know, you can only stand on two logs for so long before you fall off. But I think you're absolutely right. And certainly when I'm confronted with a teaching situation, I have to ask that question. But it's funny how this resonates. Every time I've showed this paper to somebody, they started telling me stories of when they were in seminary and how somebody told them this or somebody told them that. And it started to be the kind of thing where I was more inclined to speak to the side that I did speak to. And that's why the paper took the shape it did. I was initially more balanced, and I said, too many people have had this experience that I had to make me think that this is a coincidental thing, albeit I'm prejudiced to the side of people who I think remembered what was taught and not how they felt.
We need to close the session now. Those of you that would like can remain to converse with our speakers. I'm also asked to announce that the owner of a light brown Oldsmobile Omega Utah license plate 171 CCP should contact the front desk.